Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. And I'm waiting to get on the line with our interviewee of the week up in Maine. His name is Brian Kevin, and he's the author of The Footloose American, Following the Hunter S. Thompson Trail Across South America. So it's very exciting for us here at Columbia Calling to have yet another author on the show willing to talk to us about his product. The book came out roughly 6 months ago. A large portion of it is based in Colombia, but for any sort of lover of South America, I would highly recommend this book. I haven't read it all. I've got through the Colombia section and some of the Ecuador section, but what I can see is that it takes in a bit of Paraguay, Uruguay, Brazil, and so on. And of course, taking on board Hunter S. Thompson's letters and articles for a newspaper back in the 1960s when he was traveling in this area. Can you imagine traveling in Colombia at the tail end of La Violencia? Can you imagine going through sort of Bolivia or Paraguay at these periods of time? I mean, it's very strange indeed to try and picture them. Of course, we see black and white photography of sort of, generals and military dictators goose-stepping through the plazas de Bolívar in various countries, but to actually do it and be on the ground, you know, it's a very close contemporary history, let's say. So it's very exciting. So we'll have Brian Kevin on the show, of course. And we're always looking forward and looking out for people writing in interesting emails. We had the interesting email last week that I read out from Mr. Joel Wakefield in the US. So if you want to get in touch with us, that's columbiacalling@gmail.com. And, of course, our website, columbiacallingradio.com. And we're on Twitter, @columbiacalling. So what have I been doing? Well, you know, since having been off to Mompos and checking up on the on the Chuso, as they say there, or the little hotel up there, I've been busy. So we're going to undertake some more renovations of the Casa Maria. So for those of you who have been out to Mompos and visited us, hopefully within a few months, we'll have our sitting rooms redecorated. You know, it's a step-by-step process. I'm no millionaire, and I can't go about splashing the cash and then just making them ultra-modern or ultra-chic hotel. You know, I have to earn my money and little by little go about changing. And I think my repeat clientele very much enjoy that, because each time they come, they see something else and it's been carefully considered and executed. So that's the story on the Mompos front, and very exciting there, always change. And Colombian news, I guess the most important thing is that President Juan Manuel Santos has been touring Europe. That's five countries and the European Parliament, so Portugal, Spain, France, Germany, he's been in Belgium, and of course he'll be in the UK, or he has been in the UK, and he's looking for money for a post-conflict period, and to be able to, you know, create a post-conflict period. So the estimates are billions upon billions of dollars needed to invest, to bring, let's say, the guerrillas out of combat, and engage them into society, as I say, reintegrate them into society. So it's billions and billions of dollars, and of course he's got a five-point sort of plan that President Santos wrote up in El País newspaper, saying, of course, cocaine production would then be reduced, you know, so therefore less cocaine on the streets of Europe. Colombia is a food and agricultural country, so that would create a sort of food security for the rest of the world. Colombia has low inflation rates and high investment rates, and so therefore, you know, it will continue to grow. And I can't for the life of me remember the last one, but he's got them all set up, and you can check that out in El País, the Spanish daily newspaper, where he was invited, President Santos was invited to write an editorial. So that's the big deal. So we've seen President Santos hobnobbing with Chancellor Merkel, Prime Minister, no, Vice Prime Minister Nick Clegg. He's been up there with President Rajoy. He's been with the President of Belgium. He's been with the King of Spain. I mean, anyone who's he's been there. So drumming up support. But this may not be the right time to do so because, you know, Europe's not in the best situation to be handing out cash. So we'll see. A lot of banquets and little cash, maybe, but we'll see. I mean, you know, we've got to peg our hopes to this. We've got to be positive. You know, he's out there in Europe selling peace while Uribe is back here torpedoing everything. So, you know, what would you prefer to see? What would I prefer to see? I would prefer to see lasting, durable peace. Not at any cost, but of course, done the right way. So this is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. Don't go away. We'll be back with Brian Kevin up there in Maine.
And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McColl here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And our very special guest this week is Brian Kevin. Brian is a native of Wisconsin, but living at the moment in Maine, where we have the pleasure of speaking to him over Skype. And we've got him on the show because out of the blue, I go back to Mompos last week and I go back for, let's say, a week just to make sure everything's running fine and check up on my staff, give them a break. And lo and behold, there's a package for me, well, directed to the Casa Maria. And it's Brian Kevin's book called The Footloose American, Following the Hunter S. Thompson Trail Across South America. Now, I remember you, Brian, because I wasn't there when you came through all those years ago, but I remember your article in Wend magazine about love after the time of cholera. So, but welcome on the show.
Thanks for having me, Richard. It's good to have this chat.
It is a chat, and that's how we'll keep it. But I am most touched that you would send a book down to the wilds of Colombia, you know, for us to have, you know, and you know, you said gracias la Casa María, and it's got a very nice personalized card in there too. I mean, you know, tell us about this book. Tell us about the inspiration.
Yeah, well, I was super glad to do it, first of all, and you know, I firmly believe in the whole like kindness of strangers sort of thing. Any successful trip, whether it's like around the corner or bombing around another continent for a few months, happens because people extend hospitality, and the least you can do is pay it back in small ways. So yeah, and I had such a wonderful time at La Casa Maria. The inspiration for the book, I guess, is a combination of fondness for Thompson as a writer, a curiosity about a part of his life that it seemed to me had never really gotten a lot of attention from fans of Thompson and readers in the U.S. and folks who are kind of students of the what we sometimes call the new journalism, and just kind of a general wonky nerdiness for Latin American sociopolitics. Those three things, I guess, kind of dovetailed all together a few years ago and made me want to look into this time that he spent on the continent in 1962 and 1963 as a foreign correspondent for a now defunct paper, sort of long before he made a name for himself as a gonzo journalist or a regular journalist back here in the U.S.
And so what was this newspaper called?
Called the National Observer.
Uh-huh. It was based out of
Baltimore, Maryland, but the thing is that it was a national paper. It was kind of the, for American listeners, it was the USA Today of its day. It was actually one of the really early experiments with a national newspaper. It was a weekly and it was national, which there wasn't really anything like that at the time. It was owned by the Dow Jones Corporation, which, among other things, obviously owns the Wall Street Journal and a business paper called Barron's. It's still around.
Oh, yes.
And, yeah, and so it was kind of interesting that there was really nothing else like it, and the notion was that they were going to sort of focus more on analysis, I guess, than news breaking, seeing as how they were a weekly. And so it didn't have a huge circulation, but it kind of had the attention of a lot of people in media circles, which was helpful for Thompson as kind of a breakout role. And it lasted until, I should know this off the top of my head, but mid-70s before it kind of flamed out.
So it makes sense that, you know, Hunter S. Thompson should come down, you know, as was his wont, to do analysis, because as you put in the book, you know, it's all set against the sort of backdrop of the Cold War. Yeah. And so he's taking a look at it from this perspective of an American in the Southern Hemisphere. It's very interesting. It's something I had no idea. And I've pretty much read everything of Thompson's, I think. I mean, yeah. I think the last thing was the Hell's Angels one I did read.
Right. That's a great book. That's his first.
Yeah, and it's just fascinating. I mean, he really cuts his teeth. And so you were telling me that now excerpts of his pieces were then put into a collection called Proud Highway?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of... I mean, the fact that he took this trip is not a secret, you know, but you're right. I mean, I think a lot of people that consider themselves rightfully fans of Thompson's have no idea that this took place because, you know, so much of his legacy, the admiration of his writing and the... I don't know if admiration is the right word, but the sort of impression of his like counterculture bombastic personality kind of bleed into each other. And Thompson, the young man, kind of gets overlooked in favor of the crazy caricature that came later. But yeah, there's a collection called The Proud Highway, which is his first volume of collected correspondence. There's two. There's supposed to have been a third on the way for years, but I don't know if it's ever going to happen. So it's all these letters that he wrote as a young man leading up to the time that Hell's Angels was published in late 66. And that book contains a smattering of his letters from South America. I'm going to say there's 20 or maybe two dozen of them. A handful, five, I think, of his newspaper articles from the continent then were collected in an anthology in the late 70s called The Great Shark Count. These are both great reads, by the way, if you're a fan of Thompson or, you know, you're just interested in the era. And so... Yeah, that material is out there, but he wrote the better part of 18 or 16, depending on how you count them, pieces from or shortly after returning from South America. He was down there for a full year, took a bazillion photographs, you know, wrote letters that don't appear in the Proud Highway, although they're kind of hard to get your hands on. And, you know, it just seemed to be this formative period for somebody who... Any way you slice it, is kind of a major American writer of the 20th century that people hadn't paid a lot of attention to. But yeah, the Cold War thing is pivotal because he was kind of a shrewd enough young man, you know, he's 24, 25, to sit down and say, like, the story of my generation is happening in South America right now. This was like the front line of the Cold War. Southeast Asia hadn't really started to happen yet. You know, Cuba had only just happened. And there weren't a ton of bureaus or a ton of reporters, you know, down there covering the story. And so he basically said to himself, if I just go and start writing shit, I can, you know, break in. I can make a name for myself in a way that I couldn't if I just stuck around here. He was in California at the time. Lo and behold, he was right.
He was right. And of course, now reading this and getting the excerpts, which of course, I'd never, ever read. It's a fascinating insight into this. Now, how did you go about finding those sort of lost articles, those lost letters?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I'm hoping they won't be lost for long. I sat down and dug through. So the National Observer is collected on microfilm in not a ton of places, but a handful of places. Your larger American metropolitan libraries will likely have it. A handful of larger universities with research collections. I originally found it in a microfilm archive at Northwestern University in Chicago, where I happened to be passing through and had some time to kill and dug them up sort of with the long-term goal of maybe I would do something with them as a writing project, but also as entertainment. I was visiting someone in Chicago at the time. She happened to work at Northwestern University. I had daytime to kill while she was at work, and so I hunkered down in the library and dug these up. I've since refreshed my stash at the Boston Public Library, and so they're out there, but you know, they don't live on the internet, for example, yet. And it kind of takes some legwork to go find them. I am actually in the works right now of finding a venue that will take my scans of these. Now that I'm kind of done with them, I would really like to see them out there. Just for public consumption, for other fans of Thompson's, for researchers, for scholars to have access to. And there's nothing stopping anyone from, you know, doing what I did. But it's 2014, and if something isn't on the internet, it kind of might as well not exist, you know?
It's true, but you did all the hard work. I mean, you know, fortuitously, you have this friend at Northwestern who gets you the access to the libraries and the microfilm, but equally, you were out there, you know, sweating over the books or over, let's say, over the camera.
Yeah. But it was a pleasure. You know, I mean, I would have loved to just sat down and read through these. And it gets off the South America topic a little bit, but he continued reporting for the National Observer thereafter. And I still haven't dug up all those articles, but just reading some of that undiscovered stuff. You know, it's cool because I'm interested in the sort of topics that he was writing about. And what became immediately apparent, and that sort of led to the book as a project, was the fact that a lot of the topics he was covering 50 years ago, whether it was, pardon me if I nerd out here for a minute, but like over-reliance on resource extraction, or the lure of populist politics, or the like increasing political clout of indigenous people, or a handful of other things, like it really quickly became apparent, like these stories are still playing out in a huge way 50 years later, like still shaping this part of the world. And so, you know, what the book does is kind of one at a time checks in on those topics. But I would have been happy just to read through his work to kind of see the other aspect of it, which is that you see his emerging style kind of coming through a little bit. A lot of it is pretty straight newspaper journalism. Some of it is more sort of feature style, voicey, glimmers of gonzo is a phrase I've used before. It's a little gimmicky, but it's kind of what it is. So there's some interesting stuff there. If you've ever read Hemingway's sort of newspaper work for the Toronto Star as a young man, I compare it a lot to that. Like it's not something you might ordinarily pick up and read through if it wasn't written by Ernest Hemingway, but knowing what you know about Ernest Hemingway or Hunter Thompson, it becomes kind of fascinating.
That's very interesting. No, I have no problem if you nerd out at any point. Our listeners, I think, are quite keen on this kind of detail. Now, what can you just remind me what year you came down to Latin America, to South America, to this?
Well, and as you get to the author's note, you'll see where I kind of cop to the pastiche here, but I came down to Colombia for the first time in 2009, and that was when the notion of a book kind of crystallized for me. I found myself with a stretch of free time all of a sudden, had sort of been contemplating. I'd been thinking a lot about this time in Thompson's life and what a shame it was nobody had paid any attention to it. A bunch of crazy stuff happened in my life where all of a sudden I was a little directionless. And so I cashed in a bunch of frequent flyer miles and resolved to go retrace the Columbia portion of the route. And so spent, I guess it was a little over 5 weeks in Guajira, and then traveling up the Magdalena River, which then became the Wend article that you mentioned some years ago.
Yes.
And then also gave me the material to write the book proposal, which gets a little bit into the kind of boring nitty gritty business end of selling a book. But when the book then sold, I picked up my same shitty backpack in 2012, flew back to Bogota, picked up exactly where I left off, and retraced the rest of what I've come to call the Thompson Trail in a trip that was, I guess, the better part of 4 or 5 months. I took a small trip in between those two as well to watch an election in Peru when I wasn't quite sure if the book was going to sell, but I wanted to see what happened. The year Ollanta Humala was elected, I wanted to come down and watch that. So I hung out in Lima for 2 weeks. It doesn't really make the book, but it was good footwork.
Well, I think that's very interesting. And I like that you've been honest and saying you went back and, you know, doing the nitty-gritty of the book sale. And I think for those of us out here in the writing industry, in the media industry, it's a, you know, it's a tiresome chore. But so you said sort of 5 to 6 months in total, and Hunter S. Thompson took over a year, more or less, or
yeah,
2 years.
Almost exactly a year, although he spent the second half of that year kind of home basing in Rio and taking little satellite trips to Paraguay, Uruguay, and Argentina. He was sort of actively traveling for 6, almost 7 months, and then got to Rio and sort of hunkered down. In his words, about time I lived like a human being for a change, and sort of lived a fairly high life in Rio for a while. It sort of all came crashing down, but I don't want to spoil anything.
Well, actually, I don't spoil anything. Because I'm not quite there yet in the book. I got through, but you know, if I were to arrive in Rio after that and had some money in my pocket, I would hunker down too. And and speaking from experience, having lived there, and my father having lived there in the 60s as well, you know, well, it's just one of those things. What a great place to hunker down if you're going to have to weather a storm. Rio is amongst the places I would choose. We're going to take a short break now, Brian, and we'll be back in a minute, just after some commercials here, and we will continue talking about your book, The Footloose American, Following the Hunter S. Thompson Trail Across South America. This is Richard McCall on Columbia Calling. I'm talking to the author, Brian Kevin, up there in Maine. Please don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, and we've got the opportunity to speak to Brian Kevin up in Maine at the moment, and he's the author of The Footloose American, Following the Hunter S. Thompson Trail Across South America. And you know, really, you've made me aware of something I had no idea about, you know, Hunter S. Thompson's travels through South America, and a period of global politics and history that fascinates me, the Cold War, and now reading about Hunter S. Thompson doing analysis for a national newspaper about that. I mean, it just sort of beggars belief that the information isn't out there on the internet yet. Of course, you're working on it because people are now knowing about it from your book. How has the uptake been on this book? I mean, you said it's been out for more or less 6 months. How's it been received?
Oh, it's not burning up the bestseller list or anything, but I think it's definitely finding its little audience of people who, you know, share this weird intersection of interests in Hunter Thompson, in you know, South American sociopolitics, and kind of in travel as such. I mean, a lot of the book then, as I guess you're probably seeing, is it sort of becomes a meditation on what we expect to get out of travel and sort of how fair we are in our expectations. It's been a ton of fun, man. I have had the opportunity to tour with it a little bit and, you know, talk a little bit at this or that sort of conference. I've gotten to do neat interviews like this one. And my experience has been, to be honest with you, that initially people tend to be more interested in the Hunter S. Thompson end of things than in the Latin American politics / you know, philosophical meditation on travel end of things. But the more opportunities you know, I sort of have to get in a discussion like this one, the more I've sort of seen that shift a little bit. Mm-hmm. It got a nice New York Times review. It got a handful of good attention here and there. I have no complaints. I feel really lucky to have been able to do it.
I think it's fantastic. And also the other thing I want to say is that I read all of Hunter S. Thompson and his articles and stuff, and I will now look out for The Proud Highway, but I am more interested on the socio-political context here in Latin America, being a Latin American specialist. That's my thing. So you're already preaching to the converted. And of course, flattery will get you everywhere by talking up this this interview. But I found it very interesting. Of course, let's focus a little bit on the section of Colombia, which does take up a large portion of the book. But I mean, Hunter S. Thompson is in Colombia in, I say, was it 1963?
So 1962,
yeah. So he's in Colombia during La Violencia, you know, a terrible time in Colombian history.
Yeah, just kind of the tail end a little bit, I guess. And he has the opportunity to sort of watch some pretty heated student protests happening outside the presidential palace in Bogota. What I've since read about those particular protests, I think they sort of were touched off in Barranquilla. This would have been in the early summer, late spring of 1962, and kind of carried over to Bogota. And he talks a little bit and says, like, things have calmed down here a little bit, but you don't have to think back too far to a time when the sort of soldiers that are standing on the periphery of this crowd were, you know, more than happy to start opening fire. And he sees, you know, a handful of heads cracked and other things. But certainly, you know, the memories of the Bogotazo are like pretty fresh. And he's savvy enough to realize that, you know, everything's still pretty raw. Yeah.
For those of you out there who are unaware of the Bogotazo, it's the event in 1948 when Jorge Eliécer Gaitán, who was the sort of presidential front runner, was assassinated in downtown Bogota. There are plaques on the wall near to on the Carrera Séptima and the Avenida Jiménez where it actually took place. Unfortunately, for many years, there was a McDonald's there, which I now think is shut down. it's usually targeted for abuse during the student demonstrations, which haven't stopped, you know, not since 62. They're still demonstrating. I appreciate what you've done in this book, Brian, because, you know, if you're bringing it to a wider audience, a bit of the misunderstood history of Colombia, then this is only a good thing. It needs to help to understand a little bit about this, you know, very confusing country.
Yeah, and I do not claim any particular expertise, you know, but it was nice because some of Thompson's experiences on the ground in 62 sort of lend themselves to giving maybe a concise primer as to, for example, the rise of the FARC. I mean, he predated that by just a tad, but he had the opportunity to sort of get a sense of the rural violence that was still pretty prevalent. He had an opportunity to see firsthand some of the student unrest and like populist uprisings in the cities, and kind of explaining the roots of what he was watching in 62. And this is something that happened over and over again as I was on, you know, the Thompson Trail. And I'm making finger quotes when I say that because it's just an invented concept. But over and over again, sort of providing an explanation for what Thompson was seeing then also serves as like a really nice, concise beginner's background to explain what's happening in a lot of places in Latin America, you know, now. Because I guess, like I said before, those storylines are all still playing out in a way that... I've never been quite 100% sure if this is a fair statement, but I think it is in a way that's truer than maybe in a lot of other corners of the world. I think one thing that you can say about Latin America, I don't know, I'd be curious if you think this is true, is that history like kind of plays the long game. you know, the events of 50 years ago, to my reckoning, still feel very, very present in parts of Latin America in a way that I don't think they do in much of the developed world, and in my very, very limited experience in other parts of the developing world. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's a very fair statement, because of course all of the, if we talk about Colombia in particular, you know, 1958 violence, 1964 the riot, you know, the founding, the official founding of the FARC, and it's still playing out, of course, with the peace dialogues at the moment. It's been going for 2 years in Havana. And then if you think about, for example, Bolivia, I mean, you know, how do you not connected to the past, even with only the news this week that the Bolivian president Evo Morales is going to change the presidential palace to create construct a different type of architectural something splendid, but to reflect indigenous heritage rather than colonial heritage.
Very interesting.
And of course, then you look at down at Argentina, and you've got Kirchner in control of what essentially is a Peronist state. You know, So everything is very, very interesting. There's a few places I can't speak for at the moment because I haven't been to recently, and of course I'm focused on Colombia. But I think the long game also has a lot to do with just everything's the long game here, you know. It takes so long to do anything, even just to go to the bank. I say that because I'm bitter from today. I was about in the bank for about an hour, so that's another story.
Funny. I mean that rears. Probably that becomes at least acknowledged, if not a theme in any sort of travel narrative or travel book about Latin America, because you can't help but taking note of that, particularly as somebody from the global north, you know, or a Westerner spending time in Latin America. But Thompson, frankly, was such a little whiner about it.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, he was not a great traveler. He gets better. And I think, you know, part of the book is tracing his evolution as a traveler, which in a lot of ways probably mimics a lot of people's sort of growth experience as the like hardships of the road that just seem unfair and completely bedeviling gradually become a source of like humor, if not a little bit of pride or something. But he starts out, particularly in Colombia, just like bitching mercilessly about, you know, lack of hot water in the hotels and the bugs on the Magdalena and all these other little details. And then you sort of watch him grow as a human being in some ways by the time he gets halfway across the continent and start to adopt this. Well, frankly, start to adopt this like serio-comic fatalist attitude that, if you ask me, really is a precursor to like what would become his trademark wit. You know, I think it's a little bit too strong of a claim to say that like Thompson's travel writing gave birth to his like eventual Gonzo voice. But you see, like, you see the glimmers of that same sort of like dark fatalistic comedy in him, you know, dealing with the like Kafkaesque runarounds of going to the bank in Bolivia or whatever it might be.
You've made me remember something in this, in the part that I've read so far. When you said Kafkaesque and you were talking about the I think the evolution of the cell phone in Colombia, where everybody has a cell phone but nobody's got any minutes, nobody's got any time bought on it. You ended up being the only person that could make phone calls.
Oh, over and over and over again. Has that changed in the last couple of years?
No, it's still the same. It's exactly the same. And people will, Colombians have that habit of calling you up and ringing off straight away, so you have to call them back, even if it's someone trying to make a sale to you.
Right.
You know, I can almost get my head around it when someone calls me to make a reservation for something and then, you know, hangs up, so I have to call them back. And, you know, it's me seeking the sale. But anyone who's trying to make a sale to me, you know, they've hung up. As you put it, from the global north, it smacks, of a certain sort of lack of education and politeness, you know.
Right. It's terribly rude, in addition to being completely inefficient. And I get such a kick out of it now. Of course, I'm not dealing with it on a day-to-day basis, but I was completely fresh on the continent when I first had that explained to me, and it just struck me as such a peculiarity. And then, yes, as you say, and I'm sure this is true in a lot of parts of the world, and I'm sure a visitor to the U.S. will pick out, you know, equally as many bizarre, inefficient, sort of situations. Right, you see that mindset just playing out over and over again in such weird, petty ways. I love it. I mean, I think that's like the total spice of travel, is all these weird little idiosyncrasies. But how long can one wait at the bank before it doesn't seem that entertaining anymore?
You know, well, that's the thing. I don't want to go into banks. I can do that with someone else. We've got an author on the line here. Listen, I think if I were to have received Hunter S. Thompson in Mompos at the Casa Amarilla all those years ago, and all, you know, I've received some pretty whiny people, as you can imagine. I would have told him how it is. Sometimes when I'm there, it just, because I end up getting defensive, because, you know, I've invested time and my heart, not only, you know, economics as well, but I've invested a lot of my life now. We're talking about 7 to 8 years into building up this place. And if you get someone going, oh, it's just a plague of cockroaches, you know, it's like, well, remember where you are, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think he might not have been the greatest guest, but he probably would have been a lot of fun to talk to. You know, then of course he's suffering dysentery for the great majority of his trip, which becomes this recurring theme in all of his letters, and that can make somebody grumpy. You know, I do think also that as I read through his letters, and he acknowledges some of these plagues, I guess, in a few of the articles where he makes himself a character, which again is this thing that he's sort of known for later in his writing that he's just starting to do a bit in some of this reportage. I do think that he, this is complete supposition on my part, I have no way of proving or disproving this, but I do suspect, based on a couple little telling details here and there, that he does begin to indulge in the sort of fictionalizing that would characterize a lot of his writing later on. I think there are places where he takes some liberties. I think there are times when he says he's stung by a bug in Cuzco the size of a Volkswagen, and it paralyzed his left leg, and he's had to hobble through the streets of La Paz using his camera, I'm drawing a blank, what do we call the thing? Tripod. As a crutch. You know, I think he's exaggerating a tad. but it makes for some really funny writing.
Yeah,
nice. And all those little, you know, frustrations are instantly recognizable to anyone who's sunk serious time into travel abroad. So there's like that shock of recognition as well.
This is true. It's very familiar to all of this. And I want to say, what's become of your photographer, Sky, who was along with you for the Columbia section?
Yeah. So Sky Gilbar traveled with me in Colombia that first initial trip to Guajira and up the Magdalena River in 2009. We remain close. I've never seen him in person since that day. Thanks to the wonders of the internet, we are in very good touch. I'm actually really pleased to report he was just married last month. He's a great guy. He's left behind photography as a full-time pursuit and is sort of your prototypical California sort of startup guy. He's been involved with actually some fairly successful photography and smartphone startups, and is just an amazing human being. One of these days I'd like to reunite with him. But you know, in the book and in our experiences together in life, we were both a bit younger then. And Sky, if you're listening somewhere, I say this with all the love in the world. He's a bit of a Lothario, so I got kind of a kick out of the fact that he is a married man as of a couple of weeks ago.
Well, this is true. I mean, this is one of the reasons that I brought him up. Of course, you sort of had him almost as a Hunter S. Thompson type character. I mean, you didn't know one, and then of course he, you know, one of the first things he says to you in this soulless was a shopping center in Barranquilla is to mention the women and point out some nurses nearby, and then you have this whole sort of a drama in the city of Onda where he's disappeared as well, but then sort of turns up in the arms of another lady.
Jesus, that I mean, if I could impart a portion of the tension and fiasco on the page that felt like living through it in real life, then I have succeeded as a as a writer. Yeah, he was a bit of a handful. And it's funny, you know, from a literary standpoint, I mean, all of this, you know, comes straight, it has a basis in reality, but from a literary standpoint, it works nicely in those opening chapters to have Sky along, because he, in addition to being maybe a bit of a Lothario and a soldier of fortune kind of guy and sort of a handful to travel with, he is also whip smart and a great sort of person to introduce one to Latin America. He had traveled extensively across the continent as an Associated Press photographer, among other things, and had like a very keen interest in all the same sorts of nerdy sociological stuff that I'm interested in. But I think it also serves to establish, I hope, in those opening chapters, the extent to which, like, I am really not a Hunter Thompson-ish character at all. And there are so many times in the book that there's this sort of, I don't ever come out and say anything like this, but it's sort of a, you know, what would the Hunter Thompson that we all picture do sort of moment, whereas I'm like, well, I just, you know, I just got this copy of the Ecuador Reader and I was really hoping to read the Catholicism and Democracy chapter tonight, and I think I'll just stay in tonight, guys. you know, but Thompson was a more of a serious young guy at 24 and 25 than the popular image of Thompson. You know,
it wasn't the image of Fear and Loathing.
No, it was trending in that direction, perhaps. I mean, he could raise a little bit of hell in the manner of Sky, but I think he also was at heart a nerd, maybe more in the manner of me.
But I think it was a nerd because of a lot of the, you know, when you think about the sports statistics and the sports writing he used to do, I mean, it was, you know, it's heavy on nerd facts.
That is a really astute observation. Yeah.
Well, I think I read that a long time ago. But I wanted to bring up two things. And there was, you know, I think one of Thompson's articles that he wrote was why, and you've quoted it, it's why anti-gringo winds often blow south of the border.
Yeah.
And great. I thought that was really interesting as a title. And then at the same time, I think it's in the same chapter you write, what kind of an American am I going to be? And I think this is when you start reflecting on the sort of travel experience.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, right, this piece, Why Anti-Gringo Winds Often Blow South of the Border, it's actually something that Thompson wrote, and I think he was working on it during his travels, but it was published within a few months of his return to the U.S., and it's kind of a reflection on what we've now taken to calling, although I guess there's more than one sort of definition of this, but they overlap, the kind of ugly American you know, arguably Westerner syndrome. I mean, he saw the people around him, particularly from the U.S., behaving in ways that were appalling for a handful of different reasons that he runs down. But the nut of it was sort of that, like, you know, simply by virtue of being Westerners, they sort of became instant gentry. And in the manner that power corrupts, they sort of gradually became terrible human beings. I'm very, you know, breaking it down into a digestible chunk here. That's a great piece. It's one of those that is collected in The Great Shark Hunt. So that is readable already. But yeah, and that, you know, sort of got me reflecting on this classic book that was hugely popular at the time Thompson was traveling through South America and that he couldn't not have been aware of. Although I don't recall off the top of my head if he ever acknowledges it directly, which is the book, The Ugly American, that I happened to actually stumble upon in like a bookshop in Asuncion later in the trip. And you know, still is, feels very relevant and rings very true today, which is a piece about how, you know, diplomats in the book, it's in a fictional Southeast Asian country, are sort of behaving with the same brand of entitlement and sort of disregard to the people around them that it's damaging A, the American cause, you know, B, the view that folks in other parts of the world, you know, hold of the U.S. and other developed nations, and C, like, just the world in general and the morale of human beings.
Well, of course, I mean, the ugly American could be any ugly from any nation. It's not, and you've got the example in Cali of the Brit, you know, swinging at golf balls from his balcony way up above the slums. You know, it's that sort of behavior.
Yeah, it's a really powerful little sequence that Thompson paints there, and I will forever wonder how much of that is embellished and how much of that is based in reality, but I don't doubt that that has a factual basis. It's a really evocative scene where Thompson says, I'm sort of hanging out with these diplomats and business types in Cali, and I'm on a penthouse watching this fellow just nonchalantly, you know, take a driver and send golf balls clattering onto the rooftops of the impoverished neighborhood below, and no one on the penthouse really bats an eyelash. That's the opener to this piece, and then he does what I think is a really astute kind of meditation on that syndrome, let's call it. Yeah, it's hard not to sit there then in Cali 50 years later and find yourself sort of meditating on that stuff and wondering, you know, am I going to be any better than those people? And how can I be better than those people?
This is true. Sadly, we're coming to an end of this fascinating talk. Brian, I just want to say thank you so much for your time. And, you know, everyone, go out there and buy this book, The Footloose American, published by Broadway Books. You can find it on Amazon by Brian Kevin. What stores are you stocked in, Brian?
You know, Broadway is an imprint of Random House, so okay. Lucky for me, it's got pretty wide distribution. I think if you head to your chain bookstore, if you happen to have one nearby, easier to find in the U.S., obviously, or your local bookseller, hit up the travel section is where it's generally shelved now that it's off the new shelf. It shouldn't be too terribly difficult to find, but Amazon's always got it at a discount, and I'm not anti-Amazon sort of guy, but if you do have a local bookseller, it's always good to throw them a few shekels.
Very good, that. Very good. And anyway, listener, so thank you again. Thank you very much for your time. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. We'd never met. We've never even spoken, but we had, of course, conversed via email. And hopefully this chat has been enlightening to some of our listeners out there. I mean, we're always striving for new and different people out there. And your book came at the right time, just as I had a slot open as well. So again, Brian, thank you all so much for your time. And I wish you all the best up there in Maine with all the various projects that you're working on.
I'm so glad to do it. It's great to talk to you in person, Richard, after corresponding off and on for a long time. I am crazy about Colombia. I met some of the nicest people on the planet there and made friends that I keep to this day. I can't wait to get back, and when I do, I will buy you a beer.
Oh, nice one. Well, I'm Richard McCall. We've been talking to Brian Kevin. This is Columbia Calling. Thank you for listening, and please send your feedback. That's columbiacalling@gmail.com. We'll be back next week.